You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Willie Fisher was receiving messages from Moscow Center. He was sending messages to Moscow Center. He was clearing up messes. He was keeping the show on the road. And he was paying people. He was certainly paying Kim Philby, for example, more than once.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list to keep up with the latest episode. On the 10th of February 1962, Gary Powers, the American pilot whose U-2 spy plane was shot down in Soviet airspace, was released on the Bridge of Spies in Berlin. His captors exchanged him for one Colonel Rudolf Abel, aka William Fisher, one of the most extraordinary characters in the history of the Cold War. Born plain William Fisher in Newcastle-upon-Tyne in the UK, this British grammar schoolboy was the child of revolutionary parents who had fled Tsarist oppression in Russia. Their son returned to his spiritual homeland, the newly formed Soviet Union, and became a spy, embarking on a mission to New York where he ran the network that stole America's atomic secrets. In 1957, Willie's luck ran out and he was arrested and sentenced to 30 years in prison. 5 years later, the Soviet Union's regard for his talents was proven when they insisted on swapping him for Gary Powers. I speak with Vin Arthy, the author of Abel, the true story of the spy they traded for Gary Powers. Vin has traced Willie's tale from the most unlikely beginnings in Newcastle to Moscow, the streets of New York, and back again. It's a story of Cold War espionage to rival anything in fiction. Now, Cold War history is disappearing, but a simple monthly donation will help keep this podcast on the air. You'll be part of our community, you'll get a sought-after Cold War Conversations coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. If a monthly contribution is not your cup of tea, we also welcome one-off donations via coldwarconversations.com/donate. I'm delighted to welcome Vin Arthy to our Cold War conversation.
Rudolf Abel was not the spy's real name. Spies don't use their real names at all, of course. But the man we all know, including the Soviets and including the Russians, as Rudolf Ivanovich Abel, or Abel, as the Russians pronounce it, was born in the United Kingdom, in England, on the July the 11th, 1903, and he was registered at birth as William August Fisher. And his father's name was Heinrich Fischer, and Heinrich was an ethnic German who had escaped Tsarism because he was a Leninist. He knew Lenin well. And he was threatened with exiles and exile to Germany as an ethnic German. So with a friend, he got out of Russia at the very, very beginning of the 20th century. He, as I said, was very close to Lenin. He was born and brought up outside of Moscow. He was adopted as a child. His natural parents had a huge number of children, into the teens, I think. And the father, who was effectively a farm manager and a part-time vet, decided that this particular son, Heinrich, have a better upbringing if he was adopted. And he was adopted or fostered by another German family who had no children. And the boy was given a good education, a good training, and went to St. Petersburg and as an apprentice engineer. He worked a lot in factories. He was articulate, he was well-educated, he was an intellectual, although he never admitted that, because of course it was a bad thing to be in the Soviet era and amongst the Bolsheviks. But he was very bright, very intelligent, very articulate. And he worked with Marxist thinkers in St. Petersburg, became close to Lenin, and was actually arrested in a raid at one point, jailed for a very short time, sent on internal exile to the north of Russia, then sent in exile again to further east in Russia, to Saratov, where he married. He was an engineer, married a young midwife, as it happened. But then he was threatened by the authorities with exile into Germany, where he was going to be put into the army. He would have to do military service. So he and a friend, who had another young engineer who'd spent time in the northeast of England, said, "We'll go to the northeast of England." So they crossed Russia and arrived in the northeast of England in 1902. The young wife, Lyubov Fischer, was pregnant, and her first child, Henry Heinrich Jr., was born in the northeast of England in Newcastle upon Tyne in 1902, and her second son, William, was born a year later. So it was the threat of exile that brought old man Fischer, if you like, to the northeast of England.
Did Heinrich have a job when he came over here?
When the Fishers arrived, it's quite remarkable. Think about it. The Industrial Revolution effectively begins in the north of England with iron ore, coal, heavy engineering, and of course in Newcastle upon Tyne, shipbuilding. And Fisher would have arrived in an area which was, if you like, a crucible, had been the crucible of the Industrial Revolution. He could see the class system. It was textbook for a Marxist thinker. But old man Fisher was, he was canny, and money was important. He got work, I think, as a hod carrier, where middle-class housing or working-class housing was beginning to be established. Workers were coming to the city, so he got work very quickly, and he was interested in money, fascinating, and he gradually worked his way up and got an increased income. He always rented property, they never bought, it wasn't a home-owning democracy, but they were living in better and better homes. And he eventually became an engineer at Armstrong's, the armaments manufacturer on the River Tyne. So he was always working his way up. Also, always involved in politics. He joined the Newcastle Socialist Society, became very, very active, and he remained very, very supportive and linked to Lenin. So, for example, he was getting copies of the Leninist journal, Iskra, the Spark, sent up from London, where it was being printed. He and his wife would iron them or put them through the kitchen mangle and send them to different addresses in Germany and Russia so that revolutionaries in Russia could read what Lenin was doing and thinking. And then after the 1905 revolution, he really got the northeastern working classes positively behind the Russian revolutionaries. And he was also then involved with smuggling Mauser rifle and pistol cartridges to the revolutionaries in Russia. There were arrests. Old man Fisher wasn't caught. But the evidence isn't there, but it's clear that he was very, very much involved. And one almost wonders whether he turned informer to the police to keep himself safe. But one of the things it did mean was that he couldn't get naturalised as a British subject because of this. There were questions asked by the police and the Home Office. So he almost immediately after that situation in 1907, the gun running, moved his family out to Whitley Bay on the coast at the end of the time to get away. And he actually applied for naturalisation again 7 years later, and that time it was granted.
So he became a British citizen. Did that mean that then Heinrich Jr. and Willy had that citizenship, or did they have that from birth?
Well, they will have had it from birth, if you like. They were British subjects. And in fact, leaping forward, that was, of course, one of the things that his wife and daughter were terrified of when he was arrested in the United States in 1957. Because if it had been shown that he was a British subject, treason was still punishable by death in 1957. So he would have faced the death penalty if he'd been extradited to the United Kingdom.
As far as Willie, what's he up to? He's going through the British education system, I take it?
Well, again, that is fascinating and important. The discussions are going back to his family. His mother was Russian, probably Russian Jewish. His father was ethnic German, and Willie and his older brother Henry were born and brought up in the United Kingdom. They were native British. So you've already got a multinational and multi-ethnic family there. And whether he or the family regarded themselves as British or Russian or German or Jewish is part of a very interesting mix, which we have to discuss. But going back to your question, the young Henry started school at the age of five, and when the young William started school, he was allowed to be with his older brother in the class that his older brother was in. So they went to primary school together. Heinrich really wanted a good education for his sons. He made them work. And Henry, the firstborn, was got a grammar school place when he was 11, 12, so that would put him in 1913, 1914. But there wasn't a grammar school in Whitley Bay. The young Henry had to go to grammar school in Blyth, further north in Northumberland. But the following year, the grammar school in Whitley Bay and Monk's Eaton High School was opened in Whitley Bay, and that's where the young William started grammar school, if you like, high school, and his older brother joined him in the school as well. So they were grammar school boys in Whitley Bay from 1914, and that had a huge importance to them both, a good grammar school education. And incidentally, my first research contact with Evelyn, William Fisher's only daughter, in the 1990s, she spoke good English, and I was on the telephone to her, and I asked, I was still researching, I didn't know where the boys had gone to school. And I said to her, "Where did your father go to school?" And she said, "He went to grammar school," just like a woman of that age and that generation would have said of a brother or a son who'd passed that scholarship. She was so proud of it, and clearly he was proud of it too. And the education was science, drawing. There was art as well. The sort of grammar school curriculum that we would understand by the meaning of that term now. English was, if you like, William Fisher's native language, but his father was German. His father's first language was German. His mother's first language was Russian. He had done French and Latin at school. So clearly this is a multilingual teenager. And as you can see, a very good grounding for someone who's going to go into foreign intelligence.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. How did the outbreak of World War One impact them, particularly with the German side of their family?
The outbreak of World War One was a body blow to the family. Heinrich, having a German name, He had a very, very bad time with workmates. In fact, he got a letter from the Russian consul in Newcastle upon Tyne at the beginning of the First World War to explain, this man is not German, he is Russian. The family were on the coast at Whitley Bay. Hartlepool, just down the coast, had been shelled by the German Navy very early on in the First World War. People were killed, and Whitley Bay itself was bombed during the First World War. Then there were, as the war went on, German prisoners of war were kept on the greensward on the seafront. So it had a terrific impact, particularly on Heinrich.
But with his friend Vladimir Ilyich coming to power in Russia, how did that affect things?
Russian Revolution happens in 1917. You can argue as a result of the First World War. Heinrich's old comrade is called back to Russia. He sets up a provisional government after Kerensky. And this is the beginning of the Fischers seeing that there might be a future back for them in the emerging Soviet Union. But certainly in the first 2 or 3 years after the revolution, Heinrich and the two sons were involved in the socialist and the really left-wing socialist movements in the UK. They weren't pro-trade unionist, they were pro-politics. They saw trade unionism, workers' rights, as a deviation from the real, pure Marxist theoretical view of the world. And they certainly agitated with Russian crews during the First World War. Remember, we were on the same side with the Russians during the First World War. So they agitated. They certainly agitated in the streets, distributing left-wing literature. So they are very supportive of the revolution. But as I've already said, old man Fischer was having a tough time because of his German ethnicity. And then when the war ended, there were industrial disputes. He was on strike for a lot of the time. Because of his German ethnicity, he was often kicked out of work and was seeking work in various. He became an engineer, for example, at a coal mine at one point. He also wanted a good further education, higher education for his sons. And because of their financial situation, that was becoming more and more difficult. But both boys did matriculate for university, but they couldn't afford to go to university. The Willie Fischer actually went to work in a draftsman's office at the shipyard. His father did what fathers did, got him a job in the yard. And he worked as a draftsman at Swan Hunter's Yard. But he studied part-time, evening classes, to matriculate for university. And when it looked as though the Soviet Union, the Civil War was still going on, but it looked as though the Reds were going to triumph, Heinrich took the family to Russia in 1921. So father, mother, and the two teenage boys went to Russia. Father and mother were returning home, but the two boys were going to a new land.
And that must have been a strange experience for them. It's interesting to know whether they thought of that as their home or whether they thought that UK was their home. I guess we don't know.
Well, there are things to say here. This part of the history, if you like, is very, very difficult to get into. But the most important source for my research about Willie Fischer was his daughter, Evelyn. And I did once ask her that question. I said, did your father like his time in the United Kingdom? Because he also came back to the UK as a spy in the 1930s. But, of course, the northeast of England was his home. He was born and brought up here. He was, 17? The first 17 years of his life. I said, did your father like his time in the UK, in England? And she paused and she said, "I never asked him because I didn't want him to have to tell me a lie, but I think he did."
It's a really, really interesting answer to that question.
And tells you so much about Soviet society.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So with the return to Russia, presumably because Heinrich was a good buddy of Lenin, they're looked after, are they?
Heinrich, I think, was expecting a senior position in Lenin's government. It didn't happen. He got a job with the Comintern, but it was an office job. It was bureaucracy. It was looking after communist developments in the English-speaking world. And it didn't really suit him. He was a worker. He wanted to be working in industry, in a factory, and being a bureaucrat just did not suit him. That was the first thing. The second thing is, one of the guys who had been tied up, a Latvian called Nagel, who had been tied up in the gun running in Newcastle upon Tyne, in fact, in the north of England and Scotland in 1907, was arrested and shot in the very, very early 1920s. And of course, he had been associated with Heinrich Fischer. They knew each other. We don't know whether Fischer had informed on him, for example. We simply don't know. But it's absolutely clear that old man Fischer was also vulnerable because of that. So he went back into industry and became manager of a factory in Vologda, north of Moscow. And so he moved out of mainstream politics, remained a member of the Bolshevik Party, who was an old Bolshevik, of course, an original Bolshevik Party member, and he wrote memoirs about his time in England, his time as a revolutionary in Russia, as a Bolshevik, two volumes of memoirs, but he moved out of the political field. Going back to the two boys for a moment, they were quite special. They were the teenage sons of an old Bolshevik. When they first arrived back in Moscow, they had accommodation in the Kremlin for the first few weeks, and eventually moved into a tenement block outside of the Kremlin, but still in Moscow. And the two boys, as if you like, the teenagers, the sons of an important Bolshevik, were very much involved in the Komsomol as young leaders in the Soviet youth organization, the Communist Youth Organization. They went on a summer camp, and the older boy, Henry Jr., was killed. He drowned in a drowning accident when they were on this camp with the youngsters, which devastated the family. The mother, Lyubov, never recovered, and it's arguable that Willie never recovered either.
Willie is now in his teenage years, or is it early 20s now?
They get to Moscow when Willie is 17, I say months after this tragedy with the older brother, that he's called up into the Red Army. And that is a significant period in his life. He's a radio operator in the Red Army, has comrades, and this is a very important period for him. But just pausing there for a moment, the Soviet histories of Willy Fischer, the man who they know continue to call Abel or Abel, is that he learnt it all as a schoolboy in Moscow and as a radio operator in the Red Army. This is not true. His interest in radio begins as a boy in Whitley Bay on the Northumberland coast. The ship-to-shore radio mast was just a few hundred yards from the Fisher homes. And the schoolboys, of course, made crystal sets and listened in radio was very exciting for them. It was very, very new. And that's where he began his interest in radio. It was natural that he would get into radio work when he joined the army, because radio technology was developing. And he became very close to a number of senior radio people. One of them, Ernst Krenkel, another Russo-German, who was involved in Arctic radio rescues and activities in the 1930s and indeed 40s. So joining the Red Army was very, very important. The second area of importance for Willie Fisher was he had comrades. And
you're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
A group of these young soldiers went to a party where Willie Fisher met the sister of one of the comrades, and that was Yelena. And eventually the two fell in love and married.
Is it in the Red Army that the KGB sort of see some talent in him?
Going back to Willie Fisher's love life, if you like, he meets Yelena and they spend time together. She is, in fact, Yelena began at the Bolshoi Ballet, but fell awkwardly as a young dancer and had to give up ballet and went into music, and she went to the conservatoire. Music was very, very important for the Fisher family. Old man Fisher could play the accordion. They loved classical music. So music was an important part of their lives when they were children. And Willie encouraged Yelena with her music, her piano, and her harp. So that was part of, if you like, their courtship was around music and Yelena playing. When they got married, I don't know what Yelena's father said, you know, will you keep my daughter in the manner to which she's become accustomed? But Fisher was certainly thinking, I've got to get a proper job now. I've really got to work. And Yelena's family suggested that the security services might be a very good place to get a job, because they would need linguists. They would need people to interpret and translate. So that's what took Willie Fisher into the Cheka, the Ogpu, if you like, the beginnings of the KGB. It was he got to get a job, and that seemed the perfect fit.
What's Willie's first role then in the intelligence services?
He goes into training and in the intelligence services, and he has to do everything. Again, if you look at his CV at that time, he has to talk about things like how they were on the lookout for Trotskyists, how they were on the lookout for priests who were hiding money, those sorts of things. We don't know to what extent those were invented, but he went into training. So he was in training for a period, and then he began to specialise in radio work and began to, in fact, he was involved even at the very beginning of his career with the Ogpu NKVD, was involved in training spies who were going overseas in radio work. So that happened very, very early.
When is he seen as a potential overseas agent?
So he gets married in the late 1920s. He becomes a father in 1927 or 28. So he's a married man with a small child. He speaks English. In fact, English is his native language, if you like. He's a good radio operator. So he is a good person to send abroad. He's got good cover, excellent cover. So in the very late 1920s, he's sent to Norway, to Oslo, where his job is to set up radio receiving and transmitting points in and around Oslo. You can see that he links up with sympathisers, left-wing socialists, trade unionists, Communist Party members, and his friends, his family friends at that time, are fellow socialists. His cover is as he's got a small shop selling electrical equipment, particularly radio equipment, and Yelena, his wife, sets up a dancing school, dancing classes, and the young Evelyn is a young dancer, so there are family photographs of her in a ballet tutu and so on at these dancing classes, these ballet classes in Oslo. And they're there for, what, 3-4 years in the very late 1920s and early 1930s.
That's seen as quite a success then.
He is successful at this, but there is evidence that he was suspected. Something was a bit odd about him. I think it might have been a Norwegian army officer who noticed him in these circles and wondered how he could be making such a good living out of his tiny business. And he was eventually withdrawn from Oslo for fear that he could be found out completely. But he got out before that could happen.
He's then back in the Soviet Union for a while, but he's sent back out for a mission in London, I think you said earlier.
So he goes back to Moscow. He goes into radio training again, working at the centre, and he's involved in quite important training. He is involved in the training of a young Russian-Canadian-American spy, Kitty Harris, who eventually marries Earl Browder, the head of the Communist Party of the United States. And Kitty Harris is trained and as a radio operator and an illegal spy. Willie Fisher is her radio training tutor. So he's working in training. He also becomes friendly with the real Rudolf Abel at this time. And in fact, going back to one of my sources, the late Kirill Henkin, who knew both these men, he said that they were so close and that they both did radio that they were rather like a music hall joke, a sort of the Morecambe and Wise, if you like, of the NKVD. And sometimes the senior officers would mistake one for the other. They'd call Fisher Abel and Abel Fisher. And they sometimes referred to both of them as Fisher Abel because they were so close. So this is when Willie Fisher meets Rudolf Abel. And then he's sent to London for a short while. Again, he's setting up radio receiving and transmitting units and sites. And there is an argument. There is some evidence, but I'm putting two and two together. I hope I'm making four, but it could be five. But the Russian physicist, Pyotr Kapitsa, who some would argue was the father of the Soviet atomic bomb, although there's debate about that, but he's a significant physicist. I would argue that he was more important in developing low-temperature fuel for the big Soviet rockets of the 1940s and 50s, rather than the atomic bomb itself. But Pyotr Kapitsa was called back to Russia for a conference. His wife and two sons remained in Cambridge, where he was a professor. It's my strong feeling that Willie Fisher was involved in getting Kapitsa's laboratory equipment and the Kapitsa wife and children back to Moscow. I think there's strong evidence for that. But again, Fisher wasn't in London for very long because his case officer, Andre Deutsch, was spotted by someone. And so he was withdrawn. Deutsch was withdrawn. and Fisher was withdrawn soon afterwards.
In this period, Stalin has gained power. How does Willy and the rest of the family fare in the purges?
Willy Fisher's father, Heinrich, dies in 1935. He's an old Bolshevik that Stalin is trying to wipe out the old Bolsheviks. He's using, Lenin as the hero, but getting rid of all of those who are associated with Lenin. Heinrich Fischer dies of pneumonia in 1935, and Evelyn Fischer, his granddaughter, Willy Fischer's daughter, said that he was lucky to die when he did. If he had survived, he would have been purged. Lyubov, the wife, was also unwell at the time, and she was certainly vulnerable, but ignored. As the purges went on, Willy Fisher's position did become vulnerable. But Beria and Khrushchev began to get concerned that the security services, the NKVD, was being wiped out by these purges. Skillful, experienced officers were simply being killed. So there was a move to throw them out of the service rather than have them imprisoned or executed. And it seems that this is what happened to Willy Fisher. He turned up to work, presumably at the Lubyanka one morning, and to find that he'd been sacked. So he had no work. And there is evidence that he went to Piotr Kapitsa to get help in finding work. And there is evidence that Kapitsa helped him to find translating work. And he also went to Andrei Andreev, a member of the Politburo, an old friend of Heinrich's. And Andreev helped him get a job in a factory. When the Great Patriotic War, when Russia goes into the Second World War in 1941, his services are needed and he's called back in.
So he's called back into the NKVD. And what's his war service like?
Looking back, if we were to interview Willy Fisher now, I think he would say that his greatest contribution was in the Second World War, in the Great Patriotic War. His radio service was absolutely vital. First of all, in 1941, Fisher was the radio operator, stood next to General Sudoplatov, who was head of special tasks, a very, very nasty unit within the NKVD. They were in Red Square, Moscow, in the 1941 celebration of the revolution, with the German troops close to Moscow, and Willy Fisher was in touch with the Soviet front line throughout that Red Square parade and event to let them know if the Germans were advancing. Then, and again, it was a special tasks operation led by Sudoplatov and his close comrade Leonid Eitingon. They ran radio deception games, and the big one was Operation Monastery, where the Soviets tricked the Germans into believing that there was a massive anti-Soviet, pro-German, white Russian operation, which was a total deception. But linked to that was an even more significant operation, it seems to me, Operation Berezina. And when the Soviet troops started to advance through the Soviet Union into Belarus as it is now, they captured a German colonel and turned him. And with radio messages, got in touch with the Abwehr and the German High Command, indicating that this German officer had troops in excess of 200 with him, and managed to get radio equipment, arms, medical equipment, personnel parachuted into this non-existent German army behind the enemy lines. And it was a huge success. So I think Willie Fisher would regard it as his greatest achievement in all of his service.
This is a part of his life that certainly I didn't know about until I read your book, because obviously most of the focus is on his espionage career in the US. So fascinating stuff. So towards the end of World War II, the Great Patriotic War, the Soviets, they've got agents in the US, and they're tracking the Manhattan Project. Where does Willie sort of fit into this? When does the intelligence services think, actually, he might be a good guy for us to place in the US?
Well, when the Second World War comes to an end, remember that the Soviet Union is absolutely devastated. They make lots of catastrophic errors as well. For example, there are suggestions that they thought that they might be eligible for the Marshall Plan. If these sorts of things had been thought through and developed, post-war history would have been very, very different. There may never have been a Cold War, but never discount Stalin. Also, never misunderstand that the Soviet Union was absolutely devastated. So economically, and also in terms of military intelligence and counterintelligence, and the development of communist propaganda, if you like, things were a mess. Things were held up. So really, for 2 or 3 years after the end of the Second World War, Willie Fisher is kicking his heels, and there are power struggles with what is still the NKVD. It hasn't become the KGB yet. What to do with people? There were thoughts about him coming back into Western Europe as a radio link man. But finally, it was Leonid Eitingon, Pavel Sudoplatov's close comrade, who suggested that it would be good to send Fisher to the United States to try and revive the spy rings that had really fallen away to nothing, leaving aside the group, the tiny group that was getting the atomic secrets out of the Manhattan Project. But there were spies and spy rings throughout the United States and in Canada and in South America that were sort of moribund because of the war. And they needed someone to reorganize that. So Fisher was sent back in 1947 to do that job, to revive the moribund spy rings in the United States.
Is he trained for that, or do we have any indication as to how he's prepared for that?
These things are the deepest secrets, how you train your intelligence officers and the techniques they're going to use are the deepest secrets. But he would certainly have gone through training for this. And, of course, he was a native English speaker. And certainly we know from his time in the United States that we've never heard him speaking English. And I suspect he must have had the vestiges of a Geordie accent. But, of course, the United States, and certainly at that time, was full of people who got a range of accents when they spoke English. So that wasn't necessarily a huge problem for him. He had a series of complex legends, so he travelled across to the United States from Scandinavia into Canada, down through Canada into the United States, with papers under the name of Andrew Coyotes. He then exchanged them through the NKVD resident, Grigulevich, into the papers for Emil Goldfuss, and that was the name he went by when he was based in New York. So he was trained for in the creation and management of legends, these alternative personalities and life histories. He was a radio man, and that was the key thing. He was going to be receiving and sending messages back to the center all the time. So clearly he did have a long period of training preparing him for that, but the details we don't know.
Because I was interested to see he saw Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister, before he went.
He was sent off. He met Molotov, and was, because it was clearly a very important posting, and he was going to be an important man. And it is important to say that every foreign embassy across the world has intelligence personnel in it, foreign intelligence people. And the host country knows that there are going to be foreign intelligence people in those embassies, and these people are declared. Willie Fisher was sent to the United States as an illegal, with no diplomatic cover at all. If he was discovered, he'd be on his own. Good night, Vienna. So it was a very special assignment, and he was a very special person. And the revival of these Soviet spy rings, particularly the illegals in the United States, was of huge significance. So yes, I think he had dinner with Molotov before he went, and the nasty man Abakumov was hiding in the shadows when Willie Fisher set off by train into Scandinavia to get the boat to go across to the United States. So yes, he was highly regarded, and it was a significant moment in Soviet espionage.
Yeah, it's interesting reading that he came in from Canada, because I interviewed Jack Barsky, who was a KGB spy of the 1980s, and that's exactly the same route he came through. So it's probably just a tried and trusted way of getting in and perhaps avoiding surveillance that way. What is his mission there? So he's there to reactivate these intelligence networks, but what is his cover? What is he, you know, supposed to be doing to just hide this role?
Well, his cover is as a retired, the American term is a photo finisher. That's the job. Do you remember when we used to take photographs and take them into the chemists to be developed and printed? The photo finisher would be the guy in a chemist shop developing and printing your photographs. He basically had a small business as a photo finisher, developing and updating photo finishing equipment. So that was his cover. And he did what he had done in Oslo, certainly, that he moved in free-thinking circles. Now, the Communist Party of the United States was never very big, and the men he moved amongst were, you know, if you like, young United States Army veterans, but they were free-thinkers. And they were artists, and he was also a painter. We haven't mentioned this, Ian, but he was always interested in art. he drew and painted from when he was a child, and Whitley Bay colour coats, that corner of the northeast of England, attracts artists. In fact, the American artist Winslow Homer in the late 19th century spent time living and painting in colour coats. And I made a point of researching where Winslow Homer's northeast England paintings and drawings are, which galleries they're available in the United States. And I can't prove it, but I'm convinced that Willie Fisher went to see those pictures because those were paintings of where he was from. And he made paintings and similar paintings and drawings of his own. In fact, one of the artists, Bert Silverman, who I talked to about that, I mentioned Winslow Homer, and Bert Silverman said, "Yes, that's just the sort of work he would have liked, just the sort of work he would have liked." So his cover was as a photo finisher, but also as an artist moving among free-thinking artists.
I've chatted with Bert Silverman, and that was fascinating, particularly the because he showed me a couple of portraits I'd not seen before that he'd painted of Willie. And Bert Silverman's probably his fame in this story is the painting of Willie next to the receiver that he was receiving his messages from Moscow on. What sort of intelligence is Willie's networks passing on to the US? Because I've not been clear as to how effective he was.
Well, take a step back. This is a question, Ian, that is asked a lot. A number of Soviet spies at the time, KGB men, said they resented him. Not all of them, he was much loved, but some of them resented him, saying, look, he was over there in the United States, the implication being enjoying that life, which we didn't enjoy, painting his pictures. What was he doing? When he was arrested, they found radio equipment, spy paraphernalia. They found money, but they couldn't find exactly what he was doing. Now, I've got some research on this, and researching espionage, there is guesswork. What is intelligence? Intelligence is information on which you can act. It is not evidence, because evidence is information that will stand up to cross-examination in a court of law. So looking at the intelligence, we do know that he was the illegal resident, that is, the most senior illegal, Soviet illegal, in New York in the late 1940s and early 1950s. We do know that he was there when the Rosenbergs were arrested, tried, and executed.
The story of the Rosenbergs is covered in episode 184. There'll be a link in the episode notes.
We do know that he got the Cohens, Morris and Lona, he got them out through Mexico. He warned them. They left through Mexico and they went, they did some espionage work in Australia and New Zealand before they arrived in the UK, and were key members of the Portland spy ring in the 1960s. We know all about that. Willie Fisher got them out.
The story of the Portland spy ring is covered in episode 138 and episode 139. There'll be links in the episode notes.
Theodore Hall, the young physicist who had been giving American intelligence on the bomb to the Russians in the mid-1940s, wanted to give up completely. He wanted to stop doing it. And Willie Fisher had meetings with him and managed to keep him on side. He couldn't get him to continue espionage, but he did stop him going to the authorities. And Theodore Hall eventually came as a physicist, a university lecturer, to the United Kingdom and lived out his years, dying in 1999, without his role in the Manhattan Project getting the secrets out to the Soviet Union ever having been revealed. So what was Willy Fisher doing? He was resident. He was clearing up a lot of mess. He was keeping people on side. Remember, too, that Stalin is ailing and then dies. And you could say that between 1953 and his arrest in 1957, Fisher was rather like one of those Japanese soldiers who was on an island and never gave up after the end of the Second World War. They just kept there, living the life they were supposed to be living and doing the work they were supposed to be. That's an overstatement, but not too much of an overstatement, I don't think.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
So he was keeping the show on the road, and he was also paying people who were working for the Soviet Union. So he was in New York rather than Washington. And of course, a lot, particularly of Third World countries, had their diplomats at the United Nations. They couldn't send them all over the world. They didn't have enough. So having agents, diplomats in the United Nations was very, very useful for the Soviets. So Willy Fisher was receiving messages from Moscow Center. He was sending messages to Moscow Center. He was clearing up messes. He was keeping the show on the road, and he was paying people. He was certainly paying Kim Philby, for example, more than once. I once met Anthony Palermo. Anthony's in his 90s now, the last surviving lawyer who was at the Willy Fisher trial. He was a young lawyer on the prosecution bench, and discussing with him, and he asked me the same question. He said, "Vin, what was Fisher actually doing?" And I said, "Well, I think he was an administrator." And Palermo's jaw dropped. He said, "Yes, yes, that's what it was." So I think that was his role.
You mentioned there that he paid Philby's. Presumably that was when Philby was working in the US.
Yes.
Wow. What would have been a fly on the wall for that meet?
well, he may never have spoken to him.
Yeah. Dead drop.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow.
I should also say that, and again, this is Willy Fisher's daughter speaking to me. He loathed Philby. He did not. He called Philby the traitor, and he also Philby was an alcoholic, drank a lot, and Willy Fisher was not. He loathed alcoholics. But it is interesting calling him the traitor. Fisher's life in many ways was a tragic life. Did he himself feel a traitor? Did he himself feel a traitor to his homeland? He was a communist through and through, and he survived. He didn't die in his own bed, but he died a natural death. But how did he feel about what he'd done and what he had to do?
Interesting questions. How is he caught?
He made a mistake. In the mid-1950s, he was sent an assistant. The workload was horrendous. And he was sent this assistant, Rhino Hayhanen. And Hayhanen was an alcoholic. He was a wife beater, a nasty piece of work. He arrived and Fisher realised that he'd got a massive problem on his hands. Hayhanen was inadequately trained. Again, you know, if you like, the old system falling apart. He was missing dead drops. He was losing material. And Fisher was complaining about him to the centre, really from the moment he arrived. Finally, Hayhanen was recalled to Moscow Centre. This is in 1957. And on his way back to Moscow, he breaks his journey in Paris, walks into the United States Embassy and defects. He's debriefed and taken back to New York, and he's asked about his boss, who doesn't know his real name, of course. He's got a code name for him, which is, could be Martin, it could be Mark. But a mistake Fisher made was on one occasion taking Hayhanen to the art studios in Brooklyn to give him some material. So Hayhanen knew about the art studio. Now, it took a while for the FBI to find out where these studios were, because Hayhanen was certainly not reliable. But finally, they searched, interviewed all of the artists there. From there, they got details of the hotel that Fisher was in. I should say, before this, Fisher knew that the game was up and was travelling elsewhere in the United States. But he went back to New York because he had got two large sums of money, thousands of dollars, in his hotel room and in a safe deposit box in a bank. There was a route for him to get out of the United States into Canada, but he went back to get the money before he got out. And the reason was, if he did get out and hadn't got the money, he would have been suspected of stealing it and would have been executed. So he went back to, his mistakes were, one, having shown Hayhanen where the art studios were, and through the art studios, the FBI found out the hotel room that Fisher was in, and two, going back to that hotel room to get the money. So those are the two big mistakes, and that's how Fisher was caught.
So it's the FBI who's arresting him, is it?
Yes, he's arrested by the FBI, but it's the immigration authorities who, because they then get him because he's arrived in the United States illegally. So, if you like, it's a double act. He's actually taken away to the Alien Center in McAllen in Texas, which is where, if you like, the Mexican immigrants, illegal immigrants, are taken now, some of them. So it was a double act. But then, of course, he's tried for espionage, and the illegal immigration falls by the wayside.
How does he come by this name of Abel? Is this the name that he gives the US, and he's been prepared for this for some time, for this moment?
This, of course, is where the name Rudolf Ivanovich Abel comes from. He's arrested and says nothing. And he's taken to McAllen in Texas. And finally, he says that his real name is Rudolf Ivanovich Abel, and he uses that as a signal to the centre, going back to Abel Fisher, Fisher Abel. It's a signal to the centre that it's Willie Fisher that's been caught. And there is evidence that when he went back on leave, it was before Hayhanen had been recalled. Fisher went back and had a period of leave in the Soviet Union, and actually discussed with the centre that if he were to be caught, what would he do? and it was agreed that he would use the name Abel. It would A, be a signal, and B, he knew Rudolph's name, background, history, habits, family, everything, almost as well as he knew his own. So it was the signal.
Clever. So his defence lawyer is Jim Donovan, and anybody who's ever watched Bridge of Spies will be familiar with this part of the story. So what is the defence that Donovan uses to try and at least get a possible sentence reduced or even his release?
The key point of Donovan's defence is it was an illegal entry and an illegal grabbing of this man's property. It was a very, very astute defence in Cold War terms, because he was saying, look, our society is a democratic, justice-based society, and you are breaking United States laws in arresting this man. And he ran a very, very good defence. He also took it to the United States Supreme Court, and he lost, but only by 5 justices to 4. So that was the basis of his defence. And there's no doubt, you mentioned the film Bridge of Spies. It's actually based on Jim Donovan's own, the screenplay, it seems to me, is based on Jim Donovan's own book, Strangers on a Bridge, very, very close to it. And it's clear that both the men admired each other. They saw themselves as, they had similar interests. They were highly intelligent men, and they were the perfect match. Of course, Donovan had worked in intelligence during the Second World War. Again, a hugely impressive man. Jim Donovan was on the prosecution bench at the Nuremberg War Trials and was responsible for the visual evidence. So he went through all of the photographs and the moving film of the victims of the concentration camps. What does that do to a man? I have tremendous admiration for Jim Donovan.
Yeah, because I think he was also involved in negotiations with Castro over the prisoners captured at the Bay of Pigs as well.
That's absolutely true. In fact, the family is a democratic family, and Jim Donovan was big in the New York, in the Democratic Party in New York. He actually stood in an election for the United States Senate for the Democrats in New York. I'm not sure quite the year, it was in the 1960s, against Jacob Javits, the Republican senator. But Javits was the sitting senator, and that's always a difficult task. But he was close to Kennedy, close to the Kennedys, and Kennedy chose him to go to negotiate with Castro. And not only that, Jim Donovan took his own son, John, with him. Jim Donovan introduced all of his children to the work that he was doing as a lawyer, would take them to court, explain to them the work he was doing, why it was important. And he took his son, John, with him. As a beacon of trust, I trust you, he was saying to Castro.
Incredible. I think John was taken to see Abel at one point and sang him a song.
Yes. Yes. Again, Jim Donovan took his son John to visit Abel in prison. And the Donovan family had we're talking about small kids, you know, you've seen the movie. And they had this song, Rudolf Ivanovich Abel was a very happy spy. Rudolf the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Abel Fischer wasn't very amused.
Wasn't to his musical taste, then.
No, definitely not. Oh, that's another thing Evelyn said. He didn't like hilly-billy music. He didn't like American popular music. He loved classical music.
Right, yeah. Yeah. So, what is his sentence at the trial then?
Well, again, credit to Jim Donovan. Remember, the Rosenbergs have been executed just a few years before. And in his speaking to the judge, it's done in an odd way in the film. But Donovan says, when it comes to sentencing, it could have been the death penalty. But Donovan says, no, imprisonment, because there might be an opportunity sometime to exchange prisoners. And so it turned out.
How does the idea come about for a spy exchange? And how long is Willie in prison before that point?
So he goes to prison in 57, the autumn of 57, and he comes out in February 62. So, well, do the math, five-ish years. And it is a bit complicated. There were and remain ambivalent feelings about Gary Powers in the United States. Why did he, how did he allow himself to be captured? How energetically was the United States trying to get this man out or help this man? But Gary Powers's family, his marriage was broken, but and of course his wife, the wife he was going to divorce but couldn't divorce because he was in prison, the marriage was in difficulties, and the government was talking to the next of kin, i.e. his wife. But the family, Gary Powers' father in particular, was pressing the United States government to, and staying in touch with Donovan, pressing the United States government through Donovan to try and do some sort of swap. So the pressure began there with Gary Powers' father.
During this period, is Abel in contact, or is Willie in contact with his family?
It's interesting, Willie Fisher's period in prison, in many ways, he could be true to himself in a way that he hadn't been since he joined the security services. He was a convicted spy. That's what he was, and he could be open about that. We could almost say, was a model prisoner. He didn't cause trouble. He did a lot of artwork in prison. The wardens of the two prisons actually used him to do their Christmas cards and their calendars. Prison. He painted, he drew, he played chess with fellow prisoners, including some pretty horrific criminals. But he also made contacts with Soviet spies who were in prison, and when he was released, got information back into the centre. I think there was a spy called Ponga, Morton Sobel, the American spy. So he remained faithful to his cause, the profession as a spy for the Soviet Union. But prison was relaxing for him. He could be honest about everything, to himself and to others.
Did Evelyn give you any insight into Willie's experiences at the exchange, or how he felt about the exchange?
First of all, I should say that this is the one thing that I was uncomfortable about with the Spielberg film, Bridge of Spies, because Ellie and Evelyn, the wife and the daughter of the spy, Abel, were made out to be, well, it's almost as if they came from central casting. And the actual fact is that Yelena and Evelyn, Abel's Fisher's wife and his daughter, were involved. They were in Berlin for those negotiations. So it was the real wife, the real daughter, not stand-ins, the real case officer, Droistoff, who was in charge, who were at those meetings. And in many ways, the Spielberg film makes a mockery of that aspect. So they were both there. The exchange happened at the Glenica Bridge rather than Checkpoint Charlie for two reasons, I think. One is that Checkpoint Charlie was regarded as the American crossing, and the Soviets didn't want it there because it was the American crossing. They wanted it at the Glernica Bridge on the edge of Berlin, because just the other side of the Glernica Bridge in Potsdam was the KGB headquarters for the whole of Western Europe. And it was a big headquarters. There was a hospital there. There was a swimming pool there. There was a shopping mall. It was huge. And when Fischer Abel got into the car and was driven into East Germany, it was just a few hundred yards into the KGB headquarters. In fact, the locals used to call it the Forbidden City. So Evelyn and her mother, Yelena, were there. The exchange happened fairly early, not in the crack of dawn, but in the morning. And Yelena and Evelyn had gone shopping. So when the exchange took place, the KGB officers had to run around to find them, to bring them back to greet Willie when he got back.
And did she describe to you at all that meeting?
Evelyn didn't speak specifically about that. And it's interesting, my meetings with her, we got on well and we shared a lot, but I didn't want to get too deep and too prurient for fear of her not talking to me anymore. So aspects of closeness of the family and marital relationships and father-daughter, I just picked up and developed. So, for example, it was clear to me that Evelyn and her father were very, very close, and the use of English was very, very important to them. Yelena, Willie's wife, could speak English and speak English well, but not as well as the daughter. And that was a real bond between father and daughter. Evelyn was their only child, and so the father-daughter relationship was important. She would say things about relationships. For example, Willie Fischer did not know until he got back that his best friend Rudolf had died of a heart attack before he was arrested, so before he'd given the name. And so he had to live the rest of his life using the name of his friend who had died, and who he felt, because of that, he'd betrayed. And Evelyn said, Daddy said that if he'd known that Uncle Rudolf had died, he would never have used his name. There is another piece, actually, that's worth saying there, and that is when Willie died, he was going to be buried in the Novodevichy Cemetery, the big cemetery in Moscow. But he was going to be buried under Rudolf's name. And Yelena simply put her foot down. He will be buried under his own name. So he was cremated and at the Donskoy Cemetery, and that's where his ashes are interred, not at the Novodevichy.
What was his life like in the Soviet Union when he returned? Did the KGB use him to train agents or anything like that? I mean, what did he do?
Willie Fischer, when he got back to Moscow, lived a sad and difficult life. Obviously, he could never be fully trusted again, because it would never be known what he'd given away, if anything, so he'd be tested for the rest of his life. I spoke with Oleg Gordievsky, the defector, and Gordievsky did work with Fischer in the 1960s. He said, Willie, he did not have a desk in the Lubyanka. He had a chair. He was consulted about Western questions at times. Oleg Gordievsky would sometimes get him tickets for the ballet or for a symphony. They were not allowed to speak in English, although they would love to have done. They had to speak to each other in Russian. Willie was living under the name of his dead friend who he thought he'd betrayed. So it was tough. He enjoyed his garden, a small dacha outside of Moscow, and spent time there. But the last 9 years of his life were not happy.
It's a bit like Philby. They never sort of trust you when you come back. Was that part of the problem there, would you say?
I say that it's inevitable. It's bound to happen. I guess one accepts that that will happen. He would never be trusted again. Philby's case, of course, was slightly different. Philby thought he would be lauded, but in fact, he was just an encumbrance to them, really. And it was only gradually towards the end of his life that someone in the KGB thought, well, we better use this guy. He could be quite helpful in training our people about life in the West. But for Willie, no, he... In fact, when Fischer died, he died of lung cancer and he was in a KGB hospital. His boss had microphones placed around his deathbed in case he gave something away when he was dying.
Don't miss the episode extras such as videos, photos and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. If you'd like to help the project, just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. The Cold War conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.